We see the fourth hint. He returned to the land of Israel, hated by all those about him, despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Who hated Israel in their first commonwealth? Amalek tried to destroy him by the sword. Edom tried to destroy him by forbidding him passage to the promised land, thus forcing him to die in the wilderness. The Ammonites and the Moabites fought against his establishment when Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, made war with him. The Agagites never ceased to plague Israel in its national existence. Who are these? Who are the Amalek and Edom? Who are the descendants of the Ammonites and the Moabites? Who is a posterity of Agag? If we translate these ethnic names into modern vernacular, Mitzrayim is Egypt. Hadad, we are told, king of Amalek, joined himself to the king of Edom, and they became one people. Today they are known as the country and the people of Saudi Arabia. Ammon and Moab is Jordan, whose capital is Ammon. Ammon, Jordan, takes its name from the ancient son of Lot, Ammon. Agag today is Syria. The current events of the Middle East are a rerun of an old story. The Holy Land is a stage where the world today sees Act 3 of the drama of Israel's Third Commonwealth. The actors have the same names, they have the same script and plot, identical. The story is a part of a whole drama 40 centuries old. The drama, like Abraham who came out of the land, went out because of famine. He returned a second time to the land, but was forced out again to leave because of famine. And the third time he returned, he was to never depart again. Israel today, like Abraham of old, are back in their third return to the land and have demonstrated their determination never to depart again. The lives of the patriarchs are a prelude to this drama. Abraham was hated because of his distinctive different faith and relationship with one God. As Abraham was persecuted because of his distinctive, uncompromising religious differences, Isaac was hated because of his prosperity. He was the well digger who never sank a dry shaft. Yes? His jealous enemies would fill him with the wells with stones. Jacob was hated because of his personality. He just did not fit into the mold of those about him, not even if he tried. His values were different. His purpose was more noble. Jacob never sacrificed the eternal on the order of the temple, not even with his own brother Esau. See? Israel suffers for the same reason the patriarchs suffered. Hated by all those about him. He is rejected because of his religion, because of his prosperity, because of his personality. The Israelites are not known for trying to win friends and influence people. Their long history in the stretched out centuries has taught them the vanity of such applause. The people of Israel have again returned to their land, hated by all those about them, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, United Nations, Russia, and UNESCO. Why not? If Israel should dwell alone and not be reckoned among the nations, according to Numbers 23:9, then why is Israel seated in the United Nations at all? I think perhaps because they enjoy condemnation of the nations, because we never find the UN applauding the existence of Israel. As a matter of fact, all the resolutions would make you think their only purpose was to curse Israel. The riddle would not apply if Israel's history were any different to the drama. He returned to the land of Israel, hated by all those about him, a man of sorrow and acquainted with grief. A man of sorrow and acquainted with grief, a man of sorrow, who has suffered as Israel has suffered. Who can justify the treatment of any people? A people who have given so much good to the world and yet have not only gone unrewarded, but have been rewarded evil for good. No people have ever suffered as wrongly as Israel has suffered. No people have survived to suffer so long as Israel has survived to suffer. We read David's cry in Psalms 22:1, Eli, Eli, lama azakani, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Israel's history is triumph out of tragedy. Hated, despised, rejected, driven out, the wandering Jews, rejected of men, living Israel suffers, and suffering Israel lives. He returned to the land of Israel, hated by all those about him, despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Israel is the suffering Messiah nationally. And when Jews read Isaiah 53, they can feel it all the way back through the corridors of their history. Hint number 5, if we recall, a hatred that was so great that he was put to death by the Romans. Without a biological miracle in the womb of his mother, his birth would have been impossible. As an infant, he was called the Son of God. Number 3, taken into Egypt to preserve his life. Number 4, he returned to the land of Israel, hated by all those about him. A hatred that was so great. Hint number 5, a hatred that was so great he was put to death by the Romans. Let's look at it. How can this apply to Israel? The direction of thought is now inverted. As in the first hint, you thought of Bethlehem 20 centuries ago. I thought of the plains of Mamre, only 12 miles away from Bethlehem in distance, but 40 centuries distant in time. The woman of your thoughts was a young woman, and my thoughts was an old woman. In the second hint, you thought of a man who came from Israel. I thought of Israel, from whence that man came. Without Israel, he could not have come. In the third hint, in the flight from Egypt, you thought of Joseph and his wife and her son. I thought of Joseph too, not the later Joseph, but the greater Joseph. Not the carpenter, but the prime minister of Egypt. Now, in the fifth hint, you thought of a hatred and execution by the Romans in the Jewish year 5790, or in the Christian year AD 30. The execution, I thought of, was exactly 40 years later. Exactly 40 years after the crucifixion of Jesus, in the Jewish year 3830, or the Christian year AD 70. In the common era, the same government which had executed Jesus as the Messiah, the King of Judea, in AD 30, in exact manner, executed the kingdom of Judea as a messianic nation in AD 70, 40 years later. Josephus relates that the Romans crucified until there was no more wood with which to make crosses, nor yet another hill to place them on. The same government which crucified Jesus in the year 30 crucified Israel in AD 70. Yes, a hatred that was so great he was put to death by the Romans. At the third day, hint number 6, he came out of the tomb. How could this apply to Israel? Hosea the prophet gives us an answer. In the book of Hosea, chapter 5, he prophesied the great diaspora of Israel. Ephraim is smitten, Judah is wounded. Hosea 5, 11 through 14. He prophesied in another place, dispersed Israel shall abide many days without a king, without a prince, without a sacrifice, without an image, without an ephod, without a teraphim. And afterwards will the children of Israel return and seek after the eternal one their God and David their king in the last days. Hosea chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. In this prophecy, He does not stop with judgment, but goes on to answer the question, who can regather the outcast of Israel whom lo ami, not my people, and lo ruhamah, having not received mercy, yea, the sovereign provision of God, Jezreel, is born. Jezreel means, in Hosea 1:4 and verses 10 through 11, meaning a remnant shall return from the sowing of Jezreel in Hebrew, which simply means the same thing in Greek as diaspora, that the diaspora, the scattering of the seed, will return. In the Hosea chapter 6, Israel replies to the Eternal One, come, let us return to the Lord, for he hath torn and he will heal us, he hath smitten and he will bind us up. At the end of 2 days will he revive us, and the third day he will raise us up, and we shall stand in his sight or before him. The regathering of Israel was promised by Hosea the prophet at the end of 2 days and before the third day. The question is, how long is a day with God? How long is a day with the Lord? David said in Psalms chapter 90 and verse 4, 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past and as a watch in the night. Again, Simon Peter quotes this very verse in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 8. Be not ignorant of this one thing, that one day with the Lord is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as one day. Hosea said, at the end of 2 days will he revive us, Israel, and the third day we, Israel, will stand before him. 2 days with the Lord are 2,000 years. From the scattering of Israel, Israel shall return. This is toward the end of 2,000 years from the great diaspora in 70 AD. National Israel should be revived. 1948 AD, 1948, at the end of the second day from Israel's dispersion, in AD 70. At the end of 2 days, May 14th, 1948, National Israel was revived. Jerusalem was under siege by the Romans in the Jewish year 3,228, or 68 years in the Common Era. That siege filled the tombs of Israel and scattered them among the nations. On Rosh Hashanah, in the Jewish year 5,728, which was 1967-68, Jerusalem had just been under siege again. This siege brought life and hope to Israel. The holy city, for the first time in 1900 years, was liberated. For the first time since King Solomon, 25 centuries before, Jerusalem was the Solarex capital of United Israel. The Star of David on the Israeli flag fluttered over liberated Jerusalem. From the Suez Canal to Mount Hermon, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, from Sharm el-Sheikh all the way to the coast of Lebanon, Israel has arisen and is alive forevermore. At the third day he came out of the tomb. In Ezekiel chapter 37, in the vision of the valley of dry bones, the prophet interpreted thusly, these bones are the whole house of Israel, who say, our bones are dried, our hope is lost, we are cut off from our parts. Therefore prophesy and say unto them, thus saith the Eternal One, behold, O my people, I will open your tombs and cause you to come out of your tombs, and bring you into the land of Israel, and ye shall know that I am the Eternal One, when I have opened your tombs, O my people, and brought you out of your tombs. At the third day he came out of the tomb. Ezekiel saw the Gentile nations and the Holocaust and all of this as Israel being nationally dead as a valley filled with dry bones. But then, miraculously, in 1948, we saw a shaking and a coming together bone to his bone and a rebirth of the national state of Israel. Hint number seven, never to die again. How does this apply to Israel? Will the Jewish state again be destroyed? The Arab neighbors have avowed the destruction of Israel. The PLO, El Fatah, will not cease until Israel is destroyed. By present calculations, there are over 250 million Arabs against 3 million Israelis, yet Israel lives. Many Christian theologians would clap their hands to see literal Israel to cease from the face of the earth, yet Israel lives to defy the theology that teaches that Israel no longer exists. It's there. According to prophetic expectation, Israel has been restored. And Israel is today. The national state of Israel has been reestablished according to the prophets, and no one is going to destroy it. I might add here that a few weeks ago I was reading a tract by a gentleman who was telling about how God delivered him from the Scofield Bible, and I'm not either for or against the Scofield at this point, but I'm just amazed that in 1978 this gentleman wrote a book telling why God delivered him from Scofieldism and why he could not accept the Scofield interpretation of the Bible. Now, in this book, or this little pamphlet, published in 1978, this theologian said that the reason that he could not accept the Scofield interpretation of the Bible is that the Scofield Bible advocates that the Jews will return from the nations and the Jewish state will be literally reestablished as it was of old, and the man added, which we know cannot happen according to our belief. You see, here's a man in 1978, when Israel's already been here 30 years, saying he cannot accept Scofield, who many, many years before the state of Israel predicted, or in their commentaries, footnotes, said that Israel, the Jews would be restored. Isn't that pathetic? The events between Hosea's at the end of 2 days and the third day are vividly described by the prophet Ezekiel. In the last days, the time of the end, the end of the age, all phrases appropriately fitting to the period of Israel's third commonwealth. It is interesting to observe the particular details in that prophetic utterance of Ezekiel 33-48. In Ezekiel chapter 34, we see a prophecy against the lazy shepherds who fail to lead their people back to the land, that they will die in their sins in the nations. In Ezekiel 35, we see a prophecy against Saudi Arabia for resisting the return of Israel. Mount Seir is Saudi Arabia. In Ezekiel chapter 36, we see a promise to restore the land of Israel to the Jewish people, and that the people of Israel will be restored to their land. And or the land will be restored to Israel in chapter 36, and in chapter 37, the promise to restore the people to the land. You see, in chapter 36, the land is restored to the Jews, the mountains of Israel are restored, and then the people are restored to the land. And then in 37, after the dry bones, there were two sticks, and the two sticks were put together, and they became not Ephraim and Judah, but Israel. In Ezekiel chapter 38, Gog and Magog, the head of Russia, comes against Israel with conventional weapons to drive them out of the land. We are at the threshold in 1981 of seeing that, because the Russians have moved in over 500 shiploads of arms, among which was over 30,000 tanks since September 1981, and 1980 and 1981. Then in Ezekiel chapter 39, we see Russia's second invasion of Israel, not with modern weapons, but with weapons of wood, and they are again trying to depossess Israel. And then in Ezekiel chapter 40 through 48, the rebuilding of the future temple and the messianic kingdom, establishing them firmly and forever in the land. In Ezekiel's view, Israel will never die. The general view is not nearly as dramatic as the detail of the particulars in each chapter. But if we go into the particular details of each chapter, we would see how each of these chapters would unfold, which we will not have time to do in this tape. But there's some very beautiful illustrations of how that came about. The regathering of the Jewish people, the rebirth of the nation of Israel, and how that they have been historically regathered and brought back into the land. In our publication, we will include the entirety of this, but on the tape we will omit this particular passage, because you almost have to see the Hebrew text to appreciate it. But it not only predicted, Ezekiel chapter 37, not only predicted the event of the rebirth of the nation of Israel, but exactly how it would happen, bone on his bone. It's a very beautiful picture today when we see the rebirth of the Jewish state, the regathering of the nation of Israel, and how that it's a part of that drawn-out drama of the redemption of the Jewish state and the rebirth of the nation of Israel. Even today, the appearance of the UFOs have particular sequence with the signs that would follow in the rebirth of the nation of Israel. And I only want to touch that briefly today. But just this week, when I'm cutting this tape, the AWACS sale was approved to Saudi Arabia, which was really a blow against Israel. And the day before the vote, the day of the vote, and the day after the vote, there appeared over Galveston, Texas, an unidentified flying object, a UFO. Now, I want to very briefly today, in summary, go back to the first appearance of the UFOs. The UFOs first appeared in 1947 and 48 after World War II. And how well I remember that everybody thought they were some kind of Russian secret weapon, and the Russians thought they were some kind of American secret weapon. But come to find out, nobody knew what they were, so they simply called those flying saucers or flying cigars UFOs, unidentified flying objects. But after 1947 and 1948, they disappeared. Nobody saw any more or heard any more about the UFOs. They were not seen again until October of 1956. In October of 1956, UFOs were spotted all over the world. A worldwide sightings of UFOs in every country. There were UFOs spotted during the month of October, and in a few weeks it was all over. They disappeared. They did not appear again for quite some time. Made a very brief appearance in 1961, but then it wasn't too much. Just a few were seen, and then they disappeared again, and were not seen again until 1967. In 1967, from the middle of May to the end of June, there were thousands and thousands of reported sightings of UFOs all over the world. 19, and they disappeared again. And in 1973, in October of 1973, there was a resurgence and a reappearance of the UFOs during October. Now, friends, what did God say would happen? In the last days there will be blood and fire and pillars of smoke, according to the book of Hosea. Blood, fire, and palm trees of smoke on the earth, and in the land of Israel, that would be in the land of Israel, and that there would be signs in the heavens. So what we see in the appearance of the UFOs are truly a heavenly sign, mofet. A mofet is a wonder, something you cannot explain. In the land of Israel, we see blood, fire, and pillars of smoke, which is comparable to the warfare that is done today that was not characteristic of ancient warfare. In the last days, you'll say, blood, fire, pillars of smoke on the earth, and in the heavens there shall be wonders that man cannot explain. Now, what is amazing, that the appearance and disappearance of the UFOs is perfectly sequenced with the time that Israel has been in national distress. They appeared and disappeared in 1947 and 1948 during the War of Liberation and the War of Independence in Israel. You turn back and get those newspapers that are reporting the crises of the War of Liberation against the British and the War of Independence against the Arabs, and punctuated in that period were appearance after appearance of UFOs. After that was settled, and after the state of Israel dwelt safely, they disappeared. And then they reappeared during the Sinai campaign of October 1956. And when that crisis was over, the UFOs disappeared. 1961, when Israel was on at jeopardy in the United Nations over the execution of Eichmann, there was a very brief appearance of UFOs when the United Nations were going to take stern measurements in disciplining Israel for executing Eichmann. Then, in 1967, exactly the middle of May till the end of June, the 1967 Six-Day War, UFOs again were spotted everywhere. They disappeared again and did not reappear until 1973 with the Yom Kippur War. And with the appearance of that war came the most massive appearance of UFOs in all recorded sightings during the Yom Kippur War. Now, the United States is voting to sell AWACS to the Saudi Arabians. You know, it's really comical. I don't see where there's any AWACS or beeswax in selling AWACS planes to Saudi Arabia, whose only enemy is Israel, which is supported by an Arabian army riding camels. How does the AWACS fit with that? Very simple. The Saudis are smart. They bought from the Soviet Union a whole fleet of new jets. The Saudis can use this to give surveillance to Israel, communicate it to Damascus, and Damascus can use the AWACS information in their attacks against Israel. You rest assured of one thing, that we will be regret very much the day that we've made this decision in selling the AWACS to the Saudi Arabians. We think that we're going to bid for better oil prices and better favor with the Arabs, but we don't understand, our government does not understand the thinking of the people of the Middle East. Now here, we have seen that Israel has existed, and that they were at the end of 3 days, or at the third day, they came out of the tomb never to die again. And we see how that Israel today has miraculously survived all of the onslaughts that have been brought against them. And then finally, the question comes, never to die again. We find that this drama, as set forth in this riddle, is consummated with the thought, when will the Jews be driven out again? According to the prophecies of the Bible, they will never be. But we see that Israel's regathering as a result of the world crises and the third a commonwealth accompanied by the signs in heaven, as predicted by the holy prophets of Israel. Israel is here to stay, never to die again. Daniel says that in the days of those kings, the God of heaven shall set up a kingdom which shall never end. It's not talking about some spiritual kingdom, the church. He's talking about the re-establishment of the state of Israel, and how that the regathering of this one, Israel, and the rebirth, every nation that comes against it will be destroyed, and it will grind in pieces all the kingdoms that were before it. Israel is here to stay. Let the Russians come against Israel. They will come, and they will be defeated once by conventional weapons, and then will come a world disarmament. And Ezekiel 39, I will put hooks in your jaws and turn thee around and bring you a second time against the land of Israel, this time with ancient weapons, and this time for the annihilation of that godless force. Do you ever think that Russia today, in its atheistic concept of dialectic materialism, is the antithesis of the existence of Israel? And the greatest threat to the Soviet Union today is the existence of the Jewish state. They must try to destroy that, because Israel is mocking Russia every day it exists. So that will happen. Now, in the dramatic vision of the blood, fire, and pillars of smoke, the UFOs and all these unbelievable things that we see accompanying the wars in the Middle East in our days, there are two things that are certain. Israel's regathering did come about as a result of world crisis, the Holocaust. And the third commonwealth is accompanied by signs from heaven as predicted by the holy prophets of Israel. So Israel is here. They're here to stay and to never die again. Let us stop just a moment in concluding without a biological miracle on the womb of his mother, his birth would have been impossible. As an infant, he was called the Son of God. Taken into Egypt to preserve his life, he returned to the land of Israel, hated by all those about him, despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. A hatred that was so great that he was put to death by the Romans, but at the third day he came out of the tomb, never to die again. Of whom am I thinking? Awake now from your dream of dreams. Depart hence from the riddle of riddles. Come out of the garden called paradise. Return to the outside world of logic and reason. The mind you lent me, I will return, well exercised but unharmed. Your mind is now your own. Mine is mine. In my riddle of riddles, in my dream of dreams, you thought not of what I thought. Your mind is your own and mine is mine. Who is the Messiah? Again, your choice is yours and mine is mine. In reality, the seven lines of the Messiah must apply both to Israel and to Jesus. The Christian believes that Jesus is the Messiah. The Jews believe that Israel is the Messiah. Who is right? Who is wrong? Perhaps if we look at the issue as being right or wrong, we may both be wrong. Then that unreconcilable difference between Judaism and Christianity, the question of the Messiah will always exist. Why not look at our common denominators rather than our differentials? Why can't the Jew in his historic experience of his faith be allowed to share that heritage of the suffering Messiah in the character of his people with full privilege? After all, the prophets who wrote it, the Bible, were his own. At the same time, let the Christian, who is alien to the covenant and strangers to the commonwealth of Israel, who shares no part or parcel with Israel's historical character, be likewise privileged to find in Jesus that messianic character of the Messiah to the Gentile world. The question of the unreconcilable difference between Judaism and Christianity in the question of who is the Messiah is not so much the person of the Messiah is as it is the people of each community. The Jew who reads Isaiah 53, which they call the suffering Messiah, Messiah ben Yosef, the Messiah, the son of Joseph, experiences the whole history of his people, the suffering messianic nation. There is no way that Christian can conjure up an emotional relationship such as this because he has no share of that history. He does not know the suffering of the tradition of Israel. In this respect, it is the Christian who is judicially blinded to Israel's messianic character. Likewise, the Jew can never, by the fondest extrapolation, even by conversion to Christianity, know the span of distance a Gentile is speaking of in being translated from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of his dear son. Neither can the Jew describe what the Christian means by being lost. That is, not knowing from whence one came, where one is, or where he's going. No Jew can honestly say that he is without God, without hope, without consciousness of Messiah in the world. The Jew is likewise judicially blinded to the meaning of the good news. There is no good news to one Jew about another Jew being executed by the Romans. It's bad news anytime a Jew is executed by the Gentiles. It's bad news in the ears of another Jew. He is alien to that gospel as a Christian is to Israel's messianic character. Rabbi Samuel Schwartz said, "The Bible in reality is not a Jewish scripture, nor is it a Christian scripture. The Bible is the oracle of God. The interpretation is oriented to each in his own community of faith. The Bible plainly states that Israel is a product of a supernatural birth. The Son of God who made his flight into Egypt returned to the land, where he was hated by all those about him. History attests that Israel was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrow and acquainted with grief. The Romans crucified Israel nationally at the end of two millennial days. At the threshold of twilight of the millennial day, third millennial day, Israel was brought out of his state of national death and out of the archaeological cemeteries of so-called Palestine, Israel rose in a national resurrection, never to die again. If all seven hints be true of Israel, let's face this, and this is a good question. If all these hints be true of Israel, and the Bible and the history witness to such a statement, we ask the question, is it necessary for the Gentile to accept Israel as his messianic savior? The Jew has never thought of such because he, the Jew, recognizes the Christian's right to access to God through his faith and his relationship in Jesus Christ. The Jews never question that Jesus is the Messiah to be the savior of the Gentiles. The Rambam or Maimonides and other Jewish writers attest to this. Traditional Judaism has always recognized the Christian's right to be Christians without challenge. Unfortunately, the Christian has been slow to come to the realization that the Jew has a vital relationship with God through faith in the Abrahamic covenant. Israel is the Messiah, and the Messiah is Israel. Gentiles had no access to God through the covenants of Israel, but were strangers to them and aliens to the commonwealth of Israel. In the economy of God, it was never intended that there should be competition between Judaism and Christianity. Each community is complementary to the other. Where does Jesus fit into that picture? Simple. Very simple. You see, about 48 years after the creation of Adam, Abraham was born. About 1948 years after Jesus the state of Israel was reborn. Then about midway between the two, about 1948 years, give or take a few, was the birth and the life of Jesus of Nazareth. With respect to time, where did Jesus fit into the picture? Let me be a little more precise. If we look a little closer, the exodus of Israel was from Egypt, was born out of the matrix of travail in the Jewish year 2248. That is 2248 years after Adam. Israel was reborn in the third commonwealth in the Jewish year of 5708, or 1948 years after Christ. Now, at the end of the present Jewish century, and the year 1980 and 81 is the Jewish year 5742. The nation of Israel, in their next jubilee, in the Christian year 2005, will be 33.5 centuries old. Where does Jesus of Nazareth fit into that picture? Simple. Right in the middle of that time. When the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his Son, made of woman, made under the law. And he wrapped up in 33.5 years Israel's entire past, present, and future. And he wrapped it all up in himself in a 33.5 years. Jesus epitomized 33.5 centuries of Israel's history. And in doing that, and in wrapping that up in himself, he personified the suffering messianic history. He wrapped it up in himself, and in this personification of the messianic image of Israel, he extended that to the Gentiles in the good news of the gospel. That's the good news, that the Gentiles can be partakers with them of this great history. The gospel was not intended to be to Israel from the Gentiles. It was in all a prophetic expectation to be from Israel to the Gentiles. The evangelical Christian may see this as a point of irrefutable proof of the messianic claims of Jesus. He must not overlook, however, that the same argument also established the absolute irrefutable proof of the messianic claims of Jesus. Of Israel. The Jew does not feel that urgency to accept Christ as his suffering Messiah, and the Christian cannot understand why the Jew feels himself exempt from that obedience to the faith. Many evangelicals admit that when they try to share the gospel with Gentiles, they witness the energy of the Holy Spirit in their own utterances and in the response of their audiences. However, the same words drop dead when spoken to a Jew. The evangelist becomes nervous, his words do not flow properly, and he vainly forces his arguments into the air. Strangely, isn't it? Very strange that the same Holy Spirit that energizes one to witness to the Gentiles fails to energize him in his witness to the Jewish people. The Jew does not feel a need to accept Messiah because he is a part of the Messiah. And the Messiah that the Gentile accept is the epitome of the suffering Israel. Israel is the Messiah, and the Messiah is Israel. The suffering of Jesus was the suffering of Israel, and the suffering of Israel is the suffering of Jesus. For the Jew to be expected to accept Jesus as the alien Gentile does would be not only redundancy to the point of hyperbole, it would be double jeopardy. Should a father say to his son, "Son, I accept you as my son"? One does not need to accept what is his or what he is. It is for that reason that the Jew does not feel that need as does the Gentile Christian. The suffering and the death of Jesus at the hands of the Gentiles, Herod, Pontius Pilate, cannot be divorced from that historical suffering of Israel at the hands of the Gentile nation. What Jesus suffered that day, Israel has suffered in the stretched out centuries. Israel is the Messiah, and the Messiah is Israel. It is impossible to separate those two. Therefore, the Jews are not without the Messiah, and the Christian is not without the hope of Israel. The preaching of the cross is to the Jews an offense. Why, Christians cannot understand that they wear crosses dangling from their necks as pious symbols of the faith. To the Jew, the cross, the electric chair, the gas chamber, the guillotine, the hangsman noose, the iron maiden, are all symbols of indignity and execution. The Jews have often been object of those applications, and they cannot glory in them. The perspective of the cross is different to the Jew than it is to the Christian. The difference is that the Christian's cross dangles from his neck, but the Jew has too often found himself dangling from the neck of the cross. One might say, well, Paul says in Romans 1:16, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, but it's not what it says in Greek. You see, the word, the dative case, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, at a closer analysis indicates that the subject of the syntax of Romans 1:14-16 is not salvation, but the gospel, the preaching of the gospel is the subject. Salvation is a result clause. And to be translated in the dative case, which is to the Jew, you must have an indirect object, and there is no indirect object in Romans 1:16. Without an indirect object, Yehudio, to Yehudio proton kahileni, in Greek, should have been translated the preaching of the gospel, which was first by the Jews, even the Gentiles. They were the instrument that brought the good news to the world, even to the Greeks. Some years ago, a fable became popular that the Jews had prefabricated a temple in Jerusalem, or in New York City of Indiana limestone, and it had been secretly hidden in a warehouse, and at the right moment they were going to ship this to Israel to rebuild their temple. Can you imagine shipping limestone to Jerusalem from Indiana? Jerusalem has enough limestone to build a 40-foot wall all the way around the state of Indiana, and shipping limestone to Jerusalem is more humorous in a simile than shipping coal to Newcastle or snowballs to Eskimos. The only thing more futile than limestone and coal and snowballs is to send missionaries to the Jews. All church history since Nicaea has proved that the most non-productive missionary effort is those that are addressed toward Jewish evangelism. Nowhere in the New Testament, by word or deed, was a Gentile ever commissioned to take the good news back to Jerusalem or to the Jews abroad. The preaching of the gospel in Romans 1:14-16 was from the Jews to the Gentiles, never from the Gentiles to the Jews. The Jews have not responded to the gospel for the same reason as limestone, coal, and snowballs. You see, if we convert a Jew to the religion of Jesus, what was the religion of Jesus? He was a Jew. The conclusion may not agree with the evangelical theology, but it agrees with history and the New Testament text. Certainly, it is sour note to those who are professionally involved in Jewish evangelism, who are missionaries to the Jews. Admittedly, the Jewish evangelism is a very lucrative work, but the principle of the Jewish purpose as the origin rather than the objective of the gospel was aptly stated by Martin Buber when he said, God who gave himself to Israel by Moses at Mount Sinai gave himself to the world by Jesus at Calvary. That is a Jewish philosopher speaking. In some phenomenon, in the observation of the good news of the gospel to the Gentiles, it's amazing that the effectiveness of the preaching of the gospel in those areas of the world where the Jewish community is strongest, the effectiveness of the message of Jesus Christ to the pagan world can be measured in direct proportion to the strength of the Jewish community in that particular area. In all the places where the Jews were indigenous, Christian churches sprang up almost simultaneously. In those places where the Jews were not present, Christianity has been maintained only by a perpetual missionary effort supported from those areas of the world where the Jews were present. The British Isles were fertile to the Christian message until the expulsion of the Jews in the 12th century. Afterward, the church suffered great decadence and apostasy. After Cromwell left the Jews back into England, great revivals of the Christian church occurred. Lithuania, for example, was the last European country to receive the Jews, and there the Jewish community produced some of its greatest sages and scholars. There, the depth of Judaism became its strongest. Only after the coming of the Jews to Lithuania did the Lithuanians embrace Christianity. Lithuania today is the strongest expression of courage of the Christian church in the entire Soviet Union, and perhaps in the world. The Russians have imprisoned over 35,000 Lithuanian Catholics who refused to let their children be taught the atheism of Marxist dialectic materialism and evolution. The Lutheran Church has defied and defeated the Russians in the triumph of their faith. Their example is an exhibit of the Lithuanian Jew who was a seed pot for that church. Not only in quality, but also in quantity and stability, the church's success is in direct proportion to the quantity and quality of the Jews in a given area. The Jews' presence in a land is the fertility of that land to the seed of the message of Christ and preaching Christ to the Gentiles. Rome, Istanbul, Constantinople became strong Christian centers because they were first strong Jewish centers. Colonial America was an extension of Europe's stale, prejudiced parochial church states or state churches. But after the Jews came to America in 1641 and were granted religious tolerance by Roger William and the Duke of York, this marked the beginning of a unique freedom of religion and worship, unharassed by ecclesiastical state authority. Where the Jews is treated with equality by the Christians soon become more tolerant of each other. As goes the welfare of the Jews in Judaism, so goes the welfare of Christians and Christianity. Where goes the Jews and Judaism, so goes the church and Christianity. Where the Jewish minority suffers, so suffers the Christian minority. Without the reading of Moses and the preaching of Jesus has no dimension. The Jews are the salt and the savor of the earth. Without the light of the Torah, the preaching of the cross is meaningless. Judaism is the necessary catalyst to the function of Christianity. There is no picture, the picture of the New Testament has to have the screen of Judaism to be projected upon for its full meaning. Much of the issue made today in evangelical circles about the New Testament church. There are two things that the New Testament church did not have. One was the New Testament and the other, a church. Every book of the Bible, not only the Jewish scriptures, so-called the Old Testament, also the 27 books of the Christian New Testament, was written by Jews. This includes the books of Luke and Acts. We will deal later with Luke and Acts being written by a Jew. But the influence did not stop there. It was carried on the first two centuries. The major proponents of the message of the good news that propagated throughout the world, the known world that day, was primarily by the Jews themselves to the Gentiles. After, and get this, only after the Council of Nicaea in 325 A.D., the Jews were excluded by bulls from participation unless they denied Judaism and converted to Christianity. Persecution after persecution of the Jews by Christendom drove the two complementary communities worlds apart, yet even now the very presence of the Jew is effective, is necessary for effective Christianity. The nation of Israel today has the most Christian churches and the Christian missionaries of any nation on earth per capita. That means per square mile, per person, per nation, Israel has more missionaries and more Christian churches than any nation in the world. It is the most widely represented denominational scope and most tolerant of worship of coexistence per capita, per square mile in the world is the nation of Israel. Isn't that amazing? The Israeli government, and only the Israeli government, is the only government in the world that furnishes free Christmas trees to the Christian citizens. Don't tell the folks in the Jewish National Fund about that, who plant those trees. But they thin the trees in Israel at such a time that they can be given to Christians for Christmas trees. Now, if that's not the Christian spirit, what could be? Just think, the Jewish National Fund could adopt Jingle Bells for its theme song, plant a tree in Israel. Israel is the only government in the world that furnishes its Christian citizens with free Christmas trees. What a distorted view we get of that reading the news and some Christian publications. Too long has a Christian looked at Judaism through over-tinted theological bifocals of Christian theology whose upper lenses are plus prejudice and lower frames are minus investigation. Therefore, the Christian view of the Jew and his religion is vague and distorted. Not only are the spectacles misprescribed and faulty ground, but the only hope is critical eye surgery. Theological cataracts must be amputated. Irving Fisher said, to learn the taken for granted is harder than to learn the hitherto unsuspected. It is just as important for a Christian to recognize and accept Israel as Messiah, as a nation, as it is a Jew to recognize and accept Jesus as a messianic savior of the Gentiles. The answer to that riddle is that it's really not essential that either one accept or recognize the other, because the purpose of God will be fulfilled despite the blindness of Israel concerning Jesus, or the blindness of the Gentile church concerning the messianic claims of Israel. Yet it would solve a lot of problems if it did. In the riddle of the Messiah, there's a certain mystique, both on the part of the Jewish attitude toward the messianic character of Jesus and the Christian attitude toward the messianic character of Israel. Paul addresses this ministry, or Paul addresses this mystery. As to the Jew, he says, blindness in part hath happened to Israel. But to the Gentile Christian, he said, I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant. The blindness that happened, passive voice to Israel, is a judicial act. The word happened occurs in the passive voice. It's something that happens from outside their own effort or control, and is restricted only in the aspect of the gospel, the good news of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. So that salvation could come to the Gentiles. If the Jew is called judicially blinded in part by Paul for not seeing the messianic character of Jesus, the Christian who does not see the messianic character of Israel is not called blind. Paul called him an ignoramus. Brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant concerning this mystery, that blindness in part have happened.